sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A brutal start for the new year. All eyes on China's next move. Earnings season straight ahead. And our guest today, Barry Ritholtz, columnist, podcast host, and money manager. All this and much more on episode number 445 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hello there, Andrew Horowitz here. And that wasn't nice at all by Mr. Market, was it? Wow. What a lousy start to the new year. For the markets, we saw some major swoons, not only in the U.S., but across the world, you know, almost every category. A couple of outliers, but generally speaking, there's a lot of things happening. You've been seeing these headlines, right? These headlines that are, well, the worst start for the year ever. You see the other ones, 2008, here we go again. A couple of bits of advice, maybe. Everybody should just calm down a little bit. Obviously, things are not good. This 5.5% drop on the S&P 500, Dow, NASDAQ, was not good for a five-day period. Clearly, a very difficult time. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. We're not sure what's going to be happening here, and we still are not at all in the same circumstance as we were in 2008. Well, particularly here in the United States. You know, you look around the world, obviously, there's a lot of other problems that are going on. But the big issue is that we don't have the concern about the financial sector, which is a core underpinning of our markets. Let's be honest. Clearly, the commodities-related industries and materials, the emerging markets to an extent, and other places around the world have some problems. There's no question about that. The question is it going to be brought back here to the United States? Now, we're not an island amongst ourselves. We're not going to be able to just skirt by and be unscathed if, in fact, China continues down the road that they have been going. And that's why there is so much commentary, so much focus in on what's happening with China. Because clearly there is a very big knock-on effect when it comes to the number two largest economy in the world. Whether or not we believe their numbers or not is another discussion. But the bottom line here is that you have to think about, well, what am I going to do from here? Now, if you're a trader, clearly you know. You're in, you're out, you're hedging, you're short, you're long. As a trader, obviously, you can play the markets and be very nimble. But what about those folks that are investors? And you're starting to see these kinds of terrible headlines. And you get concerned. And you start to hear these debates about, well, sell everything in your 401k, or these debates about, you know, you should be in all cash right now, or you know, shorting the markets, whatever it may be. How do you actually make a decision on what to do? Again, there's different ways to attack this market condition. Now, we're going to get to that in a minute, right after our guest, a little bit of a teaser. But I thought that we would really focus in on talking with our guest first today. And then when we come back, I'm going to go through some of the returns sector by sector, some of the economics that happened last week, what's going to go on next week, some of the earnings that we're looking at, as well as a bit of a kind of advice on a game plan on what to do, or at least some thoughts on what to do, because it's very uncertain. We don't know where it's going to end up. Obviously, we have some hints, some clues. There are some things out there that are giving us indications of what may be the forward look with statistics, fundamentals, technicals, but we're going to get to that in a second. And our guest today is Barry Ritholtz, Chairman and Chief Investment Officer at Ritholtz Wealth Management. He's also the author of The Big Picture, a blog at ritholtz.com, a Bloomberg columnist, and a wonderful podcast host. We'll talk about that in a second. And also a financial columnist for The Washington Post. You're doing a lot of things. You're juggling a lot of stuff, man.
It's all the same stuff. People don't realize it's looking at complicated situations and trying to figure out a way to explain it to my mom and my wife.
Yeah.
That's not easy to do. I mean, I don't know who your mom and wife are, but I'm assuming that obviously to bring it so that it's not only understandable, but that people can get through it so that it doesn't get them all twisted. That's not an easy thing to do.
That's exactly right. My mom's a retired real estate agent. My mom is a retired real estate agent. My wife is a art teacher. And so if I can make both of them understand what's going on in the economy and in the stock market, it means pretty much anyone without a technical background, without a math background, should be able to follow it.
Right. You know, by the way, just a little history. Do you remember the first time, I'll just give you a quick history trivia question, the first time you were actually a guest on this podcast? Maybe the year?
It's got to be like 6 years ago, yep. Right? Five years ago?
August 5th, 2007.
Wow, 8 years ago.
Yep.
That's amazing. 9 years ago.
That's when people are like, what's a podcast?
That time flies when you're crashing economy.
Yeah, exactly. So I wanted to mention something to everybody that Barry is also, I think this could be your latest venture. You are the host of Masters in Business, a podcast hosted by Bloomberg, and you've had some just amazing guests on. I mean, it's a long list of guests. I wanted to make sure that everybody knew about that particular podcast, what you do on it, and so tell us a little bit about that.
So when I started writing for Bloomberg, when they were recruiting me to join them, they like, look, we have this great playground, and they have this amazing building in New York. It's one of the most technologically advanced, digitally optical wired buildings in the world, but it's just super cool. It's just a great playground filled with all these technology toys. And they have the television studios and the radio studios and all the data visualization artists that the Bloomberg Terminal uses, and just insane stuff. I've been doing financial television for the better part of a decade. And it's a love-hate relationship because, A, you love going on and talking about stuff that's of interest. But financial television, the format, it's short, it's tight, it's constantly interrupted with commercials. And you can always rely on questions like, what's your favorite stock? Where's the market going to be in a year? These are terrible things to ask people because it's really of no value to the listener. Asking someone their best guess where the market's going to be, or what their favorite stock, which may or may not apply to someone else's risk tolerances, time horizon, etc., they're just useless. So when we were discussing all the various toys and hardware and studios and all this great stuff Bloomberg has, they said, what would you like to do? And I said, I want to sit down with the smartest people I can find, the smartest, most successful people I can find, and find out how they got that way. And I was really surprised when they said, yeah, go ahead, go do that. Yeah. So someone actually there asked me, what's the elevator pitch? Give me what this is going to be in one sentence. So I said, Charlie Rose meets Mark Maron's WTF for business. And they're like, great, go do that.
Perfect.
Okay. I kind of got the sense they were like, here's some rope, let's see if you hang yourself.
Right.
And so far, so after I exhausted my Rolodex, you know, I know enough people on Wall Street, my 10 or 20 closest friends came on, it kind of generated enough momentum that I started asking some real heavy hitters, and they've been absolutely fascinating conversations.
Yeah, no, the list is really amazing. You know, you didn't mention one thing about the Bloomberg building, is that all the free food, I think, on the 7th floor.
It's the Google of the East Coast.
The best.
You first of all, the way they have the building structured, this, like, everything they do is really well thought out. They happen to be a really well-managed company. So when you come into the building, everybody gets routed to the 6th floor. So they force everybody through this one area. The food court, it's not even a court. It's just the whole floor is covered in coffee makers and food stations and cappuccino stands and But it's all fresh fruit and
right.
Nuts, and during lunch they're handing out soup. It's like a Silicon Valley tech place, only it's a technology. You know, Bloomberg is really the ultimate fintech company, and they treat their staff like they're engineers in Silicon Valley. It's really a fascinating. If you've never had a chance to go through the building, I tell your listeners, find a way to get invited to some event, some conference there, it's really an amazing place.
Yep, I agree. I mean, and it's nice also, I mean, the several times that I've been there for different things, you're always seeing somebody that like, hey, I think I know, how do I know that person? You know, especially coming out of the studios.
And that's the whole idea of that routing everybody through the sixth floor. By the way, that was Steve Jobs' concept of their new building, of having everybody have a common area they kind of walk through, because you want that serendipitous, random connection where you bump into people, hey, what's going on with that project? Oh, I just had this idea. And sometimes the best things come out of just randomly bumping into people from completely different divisions within a company, or even from outside of the company. It's quite fascinating idea.
Yep. Hey, Mike, you could listen to that on, just Google it or look it up any way you like. And you could also, of course, get on iTunes, et cetera. Let's talk about the markets for a moment. So market momentum has, or sentiment, maybe it's not momentum, but let's talk about sentiment. Sentiment seems to have snapped. This is not the first time we've seen this, but it seems that everybody's now more concerned with the things that they've been concerned about, but they didn't want to kind of deal with. They had their hands over their eyes and their ears, and they're like, ah, China, we don't believe their numbers, but whatever, fine.
Nobody believes China's numbers now, or at least nobody should have for the past 20 years.
Yep.
You see what it takes for the U.S. to put together GDP numbers. Somehow China's numbers come out the first day of the quarter, and they're exactly what they were forecast 90 days earlier. So that's how you know it's fabricated. It's
right.
A joke.
Right. But it's interesting.
At least it better, you know, the people who assemble the numbers, the first time the numbers come off from the forecast, that guy disappears, and his number two is the head of, now becomes the head of the data division, and he picks up gets the hint really quickly, this is what the numbers, what you misunderstand as a forecast, we're telling you what the numbers are going to be next quarter.
Exactly. I was telling my listeners, last summer I went to China, and I was actually first up and close and personal with the ghost cities. I don't know if have you seen those in person?
I have not. I had an interesting conversation a few weeks ago with Stephen Roach, who is the former global chief economist for Morgan Stanley, now a professor at Yale, really well-known guy. And his approach is, look, we in America think in terms of days, weeks, months, quarters. When you're dealing with 1.3 billion people in China, they're thinking in terms of decades and further. So the ghost cities, from their perspective, is we don't care about next quarter, we don't care about next year, but we're moving 1 billion people from the farms to the cities. Mike Covell, who's this weekend's guest, and now relocated from Virginia to Saigon, to Ho Chi Minh City, basically said the same thing, that they think in terms of we have hundreds of millions of people we need places for, and just because something's a ghost city today, it's not going to be a ghost city forever.
I'm not buying into
different
that.
Different perspective.
I'm not buying into that. The reason I'll tell you this is because I spoke to the people on the ground too, and I'm sure Roche has a much greater depth of people he could talk to, and Koval, who trend following, has been on my show as well, nice fella. But the problem is that, you know, if they're going to have 10 years from now, the problem still remains about the affordability, and that's the big problem they have right now. We can get into a whole discussion about this, but it still is interesting how, even if they are master architects, planners, and able to see the future as clearly as they, you know, think they can, I still wonder if in 10 years hence, if you have people moving into that building, if it still meets all the requirements of livability. I mean, you know, it's 10 years old.
They don't really seem to care much about environmental or building codes, as we've seen. But again, it's a different culture, and they look at the world differently.
Yep, I hear you. So, but going back to the markets for a second, it seemed that last year we had, last several years, we had buy the dip, of course. And, you know, when you get to any given point, we get these gigantic V moves in markets. A lot of that has been discussed. It's because of liquidity and all. But what seems to have changed?
Well, obviously, the big one is the increase in interest rates and the end of zero interest rate policy and the end of quantitative easing. The Fed, in what can only be described as the most telegraphed increase in history, raised rates. And I think people misunderstand what that means for stocks. We ran some analyses in the office, and everybody looks at it as a single variable. Hey, what happens when rates go up? What happens when rates go down? And that's the wrong approach. Markets aren't that simple, and one factor doesn't drive everything. So you have to look at a number of things. Are rates going up from low levels to medium levels, from medium levels to high levels, from high levels to higher levels. Where's inflation? Where are markets? Where are a whole bunch of other things? And the conclusion we came to was, when rates are low and inflation is low and the Fed is raising, it doesn't have a negative impact on markets. When rates are high and inflation is high and the Fed is raising, that has a negative impact on future market action, or at least a year out it has a negative impact. And so when you're starting from zero and inflation is low, there are lots of reasons to look at the world askance. There are there are reasons to say, hey, the typical post-credit crisis recovery is slow and weak and 2% or so, and that's what we're having. And we look at all the debt around the world, it's big, high and getting higher. And you look at the problems in the Middle East, and you look at the problems with the refugee crisis, there's always something to look at and say, this is terrible. Need I remind you, last year Ebola was going to kill us all.
Oh, yeah.
And the year before that it was SARS, and the year before that it was something else. If you want to find something to freak out about, there's always something in the newspapers to do that. But really, the key thing that we're looking at is, this is a post-credit crisis recovery. It tends to be weaker than average, although the most recent jobs data was really substantial and really strong. In 2015, the U.S. economy created 2.7 million new jobs. That is a very respectable number. If we continue seeing those sort of numbers, I think that the takeaway has to be, hey, the Fed is right to at least try and normalize rates. It's been 7 years since the crisis. We don't need zero. That's causing all sorts of issues throughout the system, all sorts of distortions. The sooner we can get back to normal, the better off everyone will be.
But what I find really interesting is this weird kind of market environment, I should say economic environment that we're in, where we have manufacturing, it just looks horrible. You know, we see a lot of the key economic
numbers.
Well,
when you say horrible, if you exclude autos, manufacturing looks terrible. Autos are on pace to do almost 18 million cars this year, that in the past 12 months. That's a huge number. People forget, you know, we were averaging 12, 13, 14, and during the crisis, I think it broke below 10. This is a huge number for an area that 5 or 6 years ago, people thought the automakers were dead.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an area that's really strong. Everybody who is an exporter, courtesy of the strong dollar, and I mean U.S. exporters, not U.S. companies who set up manufacturing overseas, but if you're making widgets in the Midwest and you want to sell it overseas, the strong dollar is really hurting you.
Mm-hmm.
If you're Caterpillar or a company like that, and you have manufacturing facilities all around the world, well, then you shift that manufacturing to wherever there's the greatest advantage for both economic and currency reasons. The big problem manufacturing seems to be running into is, outside of the United States, economies look fairly weak. Southern Europe is still a mess.
Mm-hmm.
Northern Europe is now dealing with the refugee crisis, which is a huge distraction. Much of Asia is tied to China. And by the way, we would kill for a 6% GDP
read
in the United States.
Right.
So they slowed from 10 or 11% to 6% as the whole global economy sort of absorbed the losses of the crisis and slowed. And if you're anybody who is tied to commodities, like the rest of the emerging market world is, strong dollar means low oil prices, low gold prices, low copper prices, low aluminum, steel, coal, go down the list. So all the exporters are hurting, and so you have a economy that's trying to chug along, but it's dragging a lot of dead weight. It's dragging all the challenge of the exporters from emerging markets selling commodities that are weak. And then you have the slowdown in China, which is reflecting the slowdown in Europe and everywhere else, because demands for those goods have slowed down. So it's not an imminent recession. It's just a fairly standard post-credit crisis, mediocre recovery, compounded by high, strong dollar and low commodity prices. It's definitely an unusual situation. The good news is, ultimately, low commodity prices are terrible for emerging markets, but they're great for the developed world. It means the cost of energy especially, but goods, services, and food is cheaper, and that means people have that much more money in their pocket to spend on other things. There's a huge lag for that push-through effect to work its way, for the pig to work its way through the python, so to speak. So for the benefits of low energy prices and the benefits of low commodity prices to actually be seen in consumer spending and retail sales, what are we, about a year from when, a year and change from when oil first started falling off a cliff?
Mm-hmm.
This should, if classical theory holds, later this year is when we should start seeing improvements in consumer spending and retail sales.
Right.
We already see that in automobiles. That's really, really good. Keep in mind, automobile financing is plentiful and cheap. You can't say the same thing about financing for houses or financing for other consumer goods. It might be cheap, but it's not plentiful. It's hard to get a mortgage these days.
Yeah. No, I hear you. I mean, what I was saying was, when I said manufacturing was weak, I was kind of wondering also about the change in the dynamic with all technology. This is a little thing I've been on for a while. But the change in dynamic of technology and what it's doing and the ability for it to create more with less time, with less, you know, people working and you know, why we have such a strong service environment here, of course. Obviously, we're more of a consumption economy these days than a manufacturing economy, clearly, because we outsource much of that. You know, there is that big distinction, I think, at least between the service and the manufacturing side of things these days. And then and on top of it, you know, you scratch your head and say, wow, look at these great jobs. I mean, who's hiring all these people? There's a lot of people being hired. Not many people being laid off, even though the oil industry laid off a ton of people. Manufacturers kind of laid off some. You know, retail is talking about laying off, but we're not seeing that, which is good. That means hiring is even stronger.
You see a ton of hiring in the healthcare sector. No doubt about that. Anything associated with STEM jobs, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, they can't get enough coders. They can't get enough of those folks. But you alluded to something that's really interesting, and let's step back and look at the really big picture. The history of technology has been a long-term story of being able to produce more with fewer and fewer people.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to, look, go back 150 years, and 90-plus percent of people worked on farms. Now it's single-digit Americans work on in the food and agricultural business. I'll even be broader than just working on farms. When you think back about the manufacturing process, that used to be a, you know, throw a number of bodies on an assembly line. Now the vast changes in that space have been automation and robotics and computer-driven manufacturing approaches. You don't need to have people screwing in tediously all these little nuts and bolts when a machine can do it cheaper, faster, and more reliably. And so we've seen the entire nature, not for the first time, but the entire nature of work and of the labor pool shift. And so the next question that has people scratching their head is, what is the next generation of artificial intelligence and computer learning and algorithms and software going to do to, now that we've moved to a service job, how many of these people can we replace with software? And so that's the legitimate, in my mind, that's the legitimate concern. I think people are a little too nervous about it, but there's definitely a change in the structure of the labor force, and technology is driving that.
You know, it'd be kind of interesting if we could all somehow master that, and then you and I could be sitting on the beach with our pina coladas as all of our, you know, robots are doing whatever particular job we need to do.
The question is, are people going to outsource that work to individual contractors' robots, or are they going to buy the robots and teach them themselves?
Yeah.
I think you have to find a way to add value to what you're doing above and beyond what has been commoditized. That's the fascinating thing. And we discuss this in the office pretty regularly. Look, plain Jane asset management has been commoditized.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to any one of a dozen websites and pay 25 basis points and have an algorithm manage your portfolio. And it'll do pretty much as well or better than any human. So if you're running an asset management firm, you have to find ways to bring value above and beyond something that's now just a commodity product. And I think straight up asset allocation models are a commodity product. Buy a book, do it yourself, or pay a website 25 bips to do it. Yep. So, and I think you're going to see that play out in a lot of different industries over the next decade. Is if you're offering a commodity service, you're going to get radically undercut by faster, cheaper, better software.
Yep, always so been the case.
If there's not a value add, if you're not bringing something additional to the table, you're in trouble. Finding out what that additional value add, finding out what you can offer potential clients or existing clients above and beyond what they could get cheaper and faster is how a lot of industry, a lot of service industry, is going to morph over the next couple of years.
Right. Let's finish up with this. You do a lot of debunking of, I would say, commonly...
Can we say bullshit?
Yes, we can say that.
So
over the years, we had things like, the weather, right? You know, things aren't good because of the weather. And you can kind of go back and forth whether that's true or not. But when you start having companies that have nothing to do with weather-related types of sales or an industry, you kind of wonder. The latest thing about constant currency, do you have any comments on this?
We went back from a portfolio perspective, not from a company perspective, but from a portfolio perspective, and looked at what the impact of 50 years of currency fluctuation was. And it turns out that sometimes your currency works in your favor, sometimes it works against you, but all told, it's a fairly random set of fluctuations. And rather than worry about, am I hedged with currency, am I up on the currency, am I down on the currency, if you're an international investor, over time, over decades, currency essentially is a wash. Day to day, week to week, month to month, it has an impact. We were talking about the exporters before, the manufacturers. If you're a U.S.-based manufacturer and you have to export in dollars, your goods get more expensive every day and have been as the dollar has gotten stronger and stronger. So I'm ambiguous over the short term because we know it has an impact. But as an investor over the long haul, I think currency ultimately ends up just being a wash.
Yeah, I hear you. Barry Ritholtz, thanks for joining me. We're going to make sure that all of the information about how to listen to you, read you, talk to you, find you, is all on the show notes for this particular episode on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And I wish you a very warm winter.
That, by the way, that's a whole other issue we can talk about. I don't understand who legitimately believes they're not going out and buying their kid a winter coat because in November it's 60 degrees instead
right.
of 40 degrees.
Right.
Like, seriously, I want to buy little Johnny a coat, but it's nice out, so the hell with him. I'm not going to get him a winter coat.
Exactly.
It's such a nonsensical thing. Andrew, thank you so much. This is always great talking with you.
All right, talk to you. Thanks. Bye-bye. Barry's great. Isn't he great? He's got a lot of really great information, and I really encourage you to read his work and check out all the things that he has to offer over on Ritholtz.com. And all the other places that he writes, Washington Post and Bloomberg, et cetera, and listen to his podcast. I think it's really great. Now, before we got to discussing things with Barry, I want to talk about some of the things that were happening here. And to recap, we talked about China. We talked about some of the things that are concerning investors right now and got into the discussion of what to do. Let's talk about, first of all, let's go back and talk a little bit about what happened last week. So we saw the S&P 500 down about close to 6%, 5.5% or so. Home builders had it the worst, down 9% for the week. Materials down 7.75%. Telecom down 6%. Goes on and on the list. Financials got hit pretty hard, down 7.5%. You know, a lot of people saying, well, financials, look at the financials. It's a good place, right? Rates are going up. The yield curve is going to steepen. Hasn't happened, though. That hasn't been the case. We haven't seen that yield curve moving in the direction that financials needed to be. People saying, well, look at the recent incredible numbers we saw out of the car manufacturers. We talked about that with Barry a second ago. Well, yeah, that's good. But, you know, to a degree, we also have to admit something. I think it's important that it's the darkest right before the sun rises, but it's also the brightest right before it sets. Well, maybe not right before, maybe at high noon. But you get my point here. The fact is that things get worse sometimes just after they're terrific, right? You know, you got to get to the peak till you start rolling over. And while I'm not sure if we're there right now, the fact remains that we did see a great jobs number. We did see that manufacturing is slowing down. The ISM number came in, again, weaker than the previous number. The manufacturing in the U.S. is continuing to be in contraction territory, while, again, we're seeing, like, you know, upwards of 300,000 new hirings and revisions to the upside for the last couple of months. The consumer services area, the ISM service index, declined a bit, 0.6 points, but still showed in the expansion zone. 55.3 was the final number. Now, we did see a rally in gold. We saw the oil, we know, have we said anything else, but oil has gone down for the last year and a half. But I'm not sure where it's going to end right now, but we'll hold on to the thought about gold for a second. We'll probably end with that discussion today. The interesting thing about next week already, here we are, it's the start of earnings season. Yep, Alcoa is going to be coming out after the close on Monday with earnings. Nothing major on Tuesday or Wednesday, but we have a beige book coming out. Also earnings from Intel, JP Morgan Chase, Rocky Mountain Chocolates coming Thursday. We got BlackRock, Citigroup, Fastenal, Wells Fargo, Regions Financial, U.S. Bancorp on Friday, as well as the January University of Michigan Household Sentiment Index. We're going to start to see a little bit about what's going on with inflation or not. We're going to get the PPI, the Producer Price Index, the wholesale inflation numbers on Friday as well, with some industrial production. And probably one of the more important things that I'm going to be looking at is retail sales. Retail sales clearly has been something that we've been just very concerned about, because while the consumer has saved a lot of money with the benefit from the low price of oil, and while wage inflation and wage pressures have not been building, there are a lot more people working than were before. And with that in mind, you have to ask yourself, why have these retailers done so poorly? Is it simply a change in behavior from shopping in stores to now just Amazon's getting it? Clearly, Amazon with 42% of the market share for online sales, pretty impressive. But the big question is that really what's happening? Or is there something else underneath the surface that is a big consideration? I don't know that answer. We're going to get a lot more clarity on this towards the end of next week. So that would be good. Now, China also has some numbers coming out this week. We saw that over the weekend, China came out with their inflation numbers, 1.6% year over year for their CPI. So still lower than the global 2% that everybody's looking for. Their PPI looked horrible, though. The producer price, it was down, I think it's down like 6% year over year. Commodity prices falling, obviously. Their overall economy showing slowdown. Just a real mess what's going on there. I mean, the good news is, yes, you could say, well, if PPI comes down faster than CPI, it could be good for the companies that are outputting. So you take your raw materials and you get them cheaper than the falling prices of your outputted items. Well, that's a good thing, but it doesn't seem to be a good thing. We don't want to see that negative PPI. We don't want to see negative inflation or deflationary pressures. There's no question about that, because that means demand is down. And because demand is down, obviously, on the manufacturing side, that's why their PPI is having such trouble. Make sense? Before we got to Barry, I mentioned some of the various sectors around the U.S. and how they were doing. I want to kind of recap for a second. If you think that was bad, how about this? Markets around the world really, really crapped out last week. We saw that twice the Chinese mainland shares were halted for trading. That's stupid. They recently put in this trading halt program that said that, well, at a 5% drop of the market, we're going to pause the markets. And then we'll open them back up, see what happens. And when it goes down 7% in total, so another 2%, we're going to halt it. Just close it for the day. Idiotic regulators, stupidity that can't be measured. Because if you think about this, just think about your own situation, right? You have a market that's down 5%. It halts, or for at least a little while. It pauses trading. What are you going to do if you see there's that much downside pressure, particularly if you're a trader or a short-term investor? What are you going to do? You're going to say, I'm out before the halt comes. Well, if that is a very simple and obvious answer, then what happens from there is that when you get the next round of movement after the markets open again after the pause, it's probably going to go down another 2% if it just dropped 5% so easily. and then they're going to halt the markets. They need to make that much wider. Well, this happened twice last week, and in their infinite wisdom, because they're so short-sighted and have no idea what they're doing, it's absolute amateur hour over there. What do? They pull the entire halt process. They just cancel it. They said, you know what? We're not going to do that anymore. Well, markets actually like that. Markets around the world actually momentarily cheered that when the announcement came. And the next day, when the Shanghai and Shenzhen and the mainland shares opened, they actually opened up. Well, they actually opened down, but then closed higher, I believe it was, for the day. About 2.5%. But for the week, China was down 13%. Africa down 11%. Australia 11%. Mexico 9%. Brazil, if you've ever looked at a chart that you want to just throw up from, take a look at the Brazilian market with they have a major amount of reliance on oil, very expensive deep drilling, deep water oil. And on top of that, the scandals that are going on there, I'll never in my life get through my head why they reelected a scoundrel who they're trying to impeach now. Canada down 6.5%. Canada's also taken a big beating these days because of what's going on in Canada in relation to natural resources. Now, sectors that are getting beat up so far in 2016. We mentioned that overall, the home builders, number one, energy is in there too. The only ones that are seeing some kind of, some steadiness, utilities are slightly up for the year, and consumer staples, which is kind of interesting. They have a good dividend, obviously, and they're doing well. They're just fractional losses. Now, here's some of the technical conditions at the end of the week. At the close of the week, only 101 stocks in the S&P 500 were above their 200-day moving average. 101, which means obviously about 400 were below. At the close of the week also, 61 stocks were above their 50-day moving average. Now, the S&P is under its 10-month and 12-month moving average. This is, you hear about 200-day moving averages, sometimes 150, 100. The 10-month moving average is something that I've watched, and it's getting me a little itchy, because when you get below the 10-month moving average and you see that the slope of the actual moving average is lower, so it starts to roll over, historically, that has not been a good time to be invested. In fact, if you look historically, it's a good time to really start lightening up on positions. The big question that a lot of people are asking, and I agree with this, is if you did sell out your portfolio, your 401k plan, your pension plan, your IRA, whatever it is, entirely, because you spooked, whether or not you have a technical reason for it or whether or not you have a fundamental reason for it, but you see things aren't doing well and you say, you know what, I see all this horrible headlines in this news and, you know, it's been a good run and I'm out. The big question always is, and you need to think about this, when do you get back in? When do you have the nerve to say, well, it's gotten to a point that I can feel comfortable getting back in? Because you know what inevitably happens. You get out. As the markets come down, it gets worse and worse. And you think, you know, if it's down another 10%, I'm going to start moving back in. But then it moves down 10%. And what happens? You say, you know what? Boy, things are bad. I'm not going to get back in. We're all, you know, we all have this, right? It's, you know, as things get worse, we get more nervous and withdrawn and scared and concerned about this because it's our money. As things go well, we get more excited and more bullish. I mean, it's just the way it goes. That's why markets move the way they do. That's why they overshoot to the upside and the downside. Panic selling, panic buying goes hand in hand. Nothing we could do about that, by the way. It's not gonna. There's no solution. And the Fed does not have a magic bullet for it, by the way. But what you do is you could use something like the 10-month moving average, a long-term moving average, for those of you who are long-term investors, to say, you know, if we are moving below and we have a confirmation that the markets move below at the end of a month, below their 10-month moving average, you could use the 12-month moving average as well. You could say, you know what, I'm going to lighten up on my positions. Now, let's get back to the second part of the question, which is, when do I get back in? Well, just use the opposite. When we move above and close above. Now, there'll be times that you get blown out and move back in, maybe kind of a couple times during that period. But again, history has shown that 10-month moving average, a long-term moving average, when you go below it and it slopes lower is a reasonable signal to start saying, well, maybe I should lighten up on some of my equity positioning. Now, again, you may get whipsawed, but just stick to at least the plan, at least to some kind of a game plan here. For those of you that are not, we'll call it day traders or short-term traders. Now, a couple of other things I want to mention. You have the key reversal indicator, which we're showing as flashing major oversold levels. Now, this is not at a point yet that it is pinned down to the level that I'd be like, oh my gosh. You know, if you were trading and you're looking for something to get back in, that you got to just like, you know, back up the truck. We saw that actually in September, it was at that level. We're a couple of points away from that. And the Spearman indicator is also close to a low point that shows a bottoming of markets. Now, again, I'm talking about multiple types of trading opportunities here. One, I'm talking about, and I'm talking to you if you're a trader. Number two, I'm talking to you also if you're a midterm or long-term investor, because there's, you know, you have different time frames, different ways to invest. And not one of those is right or wrong. It's your own trading strategy. Now, one of the things you have to realize is that you need to match your trading style to your risk tolerance. If you can't stomach, let's get crazy here, let's say a 2% drop in your value of your investments, well, maybe you should not be a long-term investor that you know, is going to just, you know, buy and hold forever. On the other hand, if you can tolerate you know, a 10% drop, and you think, well, you know, I could deal with 10% as long as the long term. I know that, well, if I'm going to be in there over the time, things will kind of average out and I'll do fine. Well, that's okay. If, on the other hand, you need to be in control and you need to be involved in every tick, well, you probably should be a short-term trader. You should be in and out rather than being a buy and hold. Again, if you don't match that correctly, you're going to just have lots of problems because you're going to do the wrong things at the wrong time. That's true. You're going to do the wrong things at the wrong time. And you'll probably do the wrong things at the right time, too. When you let your emotions get ahead of you, and you know what? I'm not exempt from it, nor is anybody else. We know that it's kind of scary sometimes, these markets. But at least if you have a game plan ahead of you, if you do some planning, do some strategizing, you're a lot better off. So the big question also comes back to why are the markets doing this? You know, what's happening with the markets? What has changed all of a sudden? We saw clearly volatility creep in a big way back in, we'll call it July and August into September. And then all of a sudden, boy, everybody was just happy. Things went straight up. And then everybody was looking at the end of the year for a Santa Claus rally, which kind of got there. It was halfway there, like an elf rally, and then disappeared. And the beginning of the year started. Wow. Now, one of the big things that's happening here is with China being weak, with China actually actively devaluing their currency, what's happening is that it's causing a lot of problems for the carry trade. Now, a lot of people in the institutional side have been utilizing short yen, short euro, or selling euros and selling yen, buying dollars and other currencies, and buying stocks, U.S. stocks and stocks around the world. Well, as China is devaluing their currency, they're selling the yuan and they're buying other currencies, particularly the euro, the yen. That's causing those to go higher. And what happens is it's taking those positions that were the carry trade for the equities, this quasi-carry trade, and is making people reevaluate that. Some positions are getting stopped out. So when they have to buy back the yen, they have to sell equities, sell the dollar. And if, in fact, the U.S. economy continues to show some weakness, for whatever reason, the dollar is also going to be coming down. The yen as a safety trade seems to be the play that everybody goes to during times of difficulty. So what's happening is that you have a multifaceted condition here. Now, there's a lot of talk about China looking to do upwards of a 15% additional devaluation of the yuan in a very quick way. Now, whether that happens or not, I don't know, but it's kind of interesting to me and fascinating, actually, that the IMF granted them their currency reserve status just recently, and then they devalued it by like 7.5%. So now that it's in that basket, people have to buy it. And China pretty much scammed their way in there, sold it out right when people had to buy it, so there was a market for it. But essentially, China is a big issue right now. There's some murmurs of what's going on in Europe, some banking issues there. But really, the global slowdown and China is a big issue. Now, there are some other economics that people are worried about, but fundamentals shouldn't be overlooked here. Let's take a look for a second at what's going on with the S&P 500. Now, the current estimate for the full year of 2015, which isn't in the books yet because they report late. So when we look at the fiscal period, it's different than the calendar. Current estimate for the full 2015 earnings for the S&P 500 is right about 106 right now. That's the latest. Now, this is down from about $135 in March. Currently, the forward PE is at current levels about 18. This is the forward PE. Is it 18? Now, we saw this. Think about this, what I just said, right? You have $135 estimate for earnings. This is back in March. We're talking about 6 months later, 9 months later, sorry, 9 months later. We're down like 30% in terms of expected earnings. And we're still not done with the whole fiscal. Now, 2016, just to show you how things don't change, in March, the estimate was for $135. This is for 2016 estimates for earnings. Now it's 125. Forward PE is 15.3 on the 2016 numbers. Now, what this means is that earnings have to grow about 20% between 2015 and 2016. Now, do we think that's going to happen? Right now, they're pretty much flat. As a matter of fact, earnings right now, if we come in at 106 right now in 2015, we're back to the levels that we saw in 2013. And the S&P, by the way, just to give you a little hint of where the values were, the S&P was in a range of 1,500 to 1,850 that year. That was a pretty wild year. But we're talking about right now, the S&P, 1,900 and change, right? Just over the 1,900 mark. Well, if we go back to the levels that we saw back in 2013, and if we take the midway point of the range of where the S&P was in that year, you know, we're talking about 1,600. 1650. Are we going to get there? I don't know. But I got to tell you something, unless something changes dramatically, and if obviously we see PE expansion for whatever reason, that usually only happens when we think that there's going to be additional growth in the future. But if growth is slowing down on earnings and sales, you're not going to get that PE expansion. And this is more fuel to the fire of why that 10-month moving average has been breached. One of the things you may want to look at is gold. I mean, with all that has gone on over the last few years with the dollar rising and the lack of any kind of volatility or concern about markets coming in, obviously gold got hit pretty good. Some of the sales by the sovereign wealth funds and countries themselves to replenish their coffers. I don't know, maybe it could be an interesting time to look at gold at this point here just as a buffer in your portfolio for some of the assets. Something to think about. Well, we're going to wrap it up from there and hope that... Well, maybe next week it will be a little bit better. There's probably going to be some overhang in terms of markets, concern, watching and worrying about what's happening in Asia, around the world, but clearly be some overhang because there's some distribution going on. One of the things that was an interesting story last week was how there was this level of selling that went on, but the VIX only ended up at about 25. When you see this kind of downward movement, oftentimes you'll see the VIX, the volatility index, spike a little more than it has. Now, it's obviously up from, you know, 15 or so or 16 recently. So 25 is not just a small number. But here's the thing. One of the reasons that's being accounted for why, in fact, the VIX isn't much higher right now is because it's been a quote-unquote orderly selling. Or said another way, the reason that we are not seeing the volatility spike as much because it's not a panic. There's distribution. The read-through from the VIX is that there is distribution going on rather than panic selling. Distribution, by the way, is worse. What I mean by this is there's not a lot of people buying volatility, buying protection because they're looking to just get out of their portfolios rather than keeping their portfolios and keeping their portfolios steady with what they have, buying protection to protect that portfolio. What they're doing is they're moving out of their portfolio. Does that make any sense? That's why we're not seeing the protection being bought at the levels that you may think they were being bought. going to have to watch that VIX and see what happens there. Anyway, we'll talk to you soon. Make sure to listen to DH Unplugged. We're going to have some good information this week coming up. Some of the stats we just talked about, but also some additional information on what's going on, because we're going to have a little bit more clarity. Myself, John C. Dvorak, will be talking and giving you some ideas of what to do also there, and talking about the news that's going on. A real interesting market prediction by a major player who says that, well, this looks like 2008 all over again. A couple of them. But I'll give you the details on that on DH Unplugged. Make sure to listen to that as well, that podcast. And of course, if you want more information, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can find out all the information about how we work, the strategies we have, as well as the show notes from this session and episode and others. Other than that, I wish you a very successful week and a profitable one too. I'll see you soon.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.